Presentation today is going to come from Dr. Lisa Cubbins, who is a senior research scientist at the Centers for Public Health Research and Evaluation at Battelle Memorial Institute in Seattle and an affiliate assistant professor of sociology at the University of Washington. She received her doctorate in sociology from the University of Washington in 1992, and her research focuses primarily on health disparities, substance abuse, HIV-related risk behaviors, and couple dynamics. Lisa?
Thank you. First, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Lisa John from Battelle, and Drs. Hill and Graeber from Eunice Kennedy Shriver in ICHD. And as others have said, no relationships to disclose on the disclosure form there. Okay, the research I'll describe today focused on the development of a brief questionnaire which measures fathers' resources related to maternal health and child well-being, and which may be included in the National Children's Study. To provide some... to provide some background for this work, we need to turn to past research, which suggests that when men are involved, when men are involved with their wife or partner's pregnancy, for example, buying supplies, taking her to doctor visits, and when they experience the unborn child, such as listening to the fetus's heartbeat or viewing an ultrasound, they are more likely to be involved in positive ways with their partner and newborn after the birth. However, not all fathers engage in these prenatal behaviors, or they don't do so during each of their partner's pregnancies. One reason for this may be that fathers differ in the type and amount of resources they have that might encourage prenatal involvement. So our focus for this may our focus in developing the questionnaire on what resources a father has, which may be related to maternal health, primarily in direct and indirect ways, such as through the prenatal involvement of fathers. We are also interested in how resources are related to child well-being, but our primary focus for this questionnaire was in terms of maternal health or prenatal health. To develop the Father Resources Questionnaire, we followed a systematic process that built on existing knowledge and existing measures. First, we determined which dimensions of father resources we would measure. Second, we conducted reviews of research literature and existing data sets for possible measures of our dimensions of father resources. Third, we conducted qualitative studies to develop measures for three of the 11 types of father resources we were measuring. And this included focus groups and cognitive interviews examining questionnaire items on father's empathy, attitudes related to masculinity, and family leave. Our fourth step was a pilot study for the full questionnaire of all 11 types of father resources that we were targeting. And I'll talk a little bit about each of these four steps. Our first step was to generate a set of possible dimensions of father resources and their elements. We broadly defined father resources as including, first, psychological resources such as self-esteem, mastery, masculinity, self-efficacy. Secondly, social resources such as social capital, social ties, social support. And third, tangible resources, financial resources, physical health, time available to support the mother. Our interest was not in standard or generic measures of these types of resources, but rather in resource measures that are tied specifically to maternal and child health in some way. To address these three dimensions, psychological, social, and tangible resources, We generated a list of over 30 possible father resources that might be related to maternal health. To reduce this list to the resources most salient to maternal health, which was, our primary focus, we consulted three experts working in the field of father involvement in maternal health. And they were Dr. Natasha Cabrera of University of Maryland College Park, Dr. Joseph Pleck at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, and Dr. Jacqueline Shannon of Brooklyn College. In consultation with the three experts, we identified 11 first priority resources to be measured. And these are, as shown on the slide, father's childhood family structure, perceived social support, couple communication, marital or relationship satisfaction, level of job stress, level of general stress, masculinity, perceived personal control, empathy, perceived role conflict or strain in being a parent, access to and use of family leave. And I should note that, of course, there are many other significant tangible father resources that we could consider here and that are also included in the NCS already. And these are father's employment status, income level, earnings, hours worked, self-reported health, health-related behavior, and then health insurance. Those are already there. So the next step in the questionnaire development process was to determine whether there were any existing measures of the 11 first priority resources we were targeting. After reviewing relevant articles and documentation from multiple large national surveys, we identified ready-to-use scales or single-item measures for all but three of the father resources. And here we drew in a number of different data sources, the National Survey of Families and Households, the General Social Survey, the 500 Family Study, Americans Changing Lives Study, scales that had been developed by Joseph Pleck and his colleagues, the Cohen Perceived Stress Scale, and from the National Survey of Family Growth. And of course, we obtained permission to use these measures from each of those sources. We had identified scales for measuring father's empathy and masculinity, but there were too many items in these scales, so we knew we needed to revise them in some way. And we also wanted to make sure that in revising the scales, that we were paying attention to those items that were most relevant to maternal health. In addition to revising the empathy and masculinity scales, we decided to develop new questions on family leave access and use. In our reviews, we found that most surveys of family leave are directed at businesses or organizations rather than toward individuals. So the next step in the measurement development process was to use qualitative research, focus groups, and cognitive interviews to revise the measures of masculinity, empathy, and access to and use of family leave for the birth or adoption of a child. The focus groups were used to gather information from mothers and fathers on how well the survey items reflected the underlying concept, masculinity, empathy, the relevance of the survey items to maternal health and parenting, and whether any of the questions were confusing or unclear. Two-hour focus groups were conducted separately with men and women, all of whom were adults, and parents or parents-to-be. The groups were diverse in age, race, ethnicity, socioeconomic status, and parenting characteristics, such as pregnancy, the number of children, or the ages of the children. The participants provided extremely useful information which questionnaire items were most effective in capturing the domains, such as empathy, which items were most relevant to pregnant women, men with a pregnant wife, or partner, or to parenting, and in telling us which words or phrases needed to be revised. The primary purpose of the cognitive interviews was to ensure that the proposed questions and response categories were being interpreted as intended by the diverse respondents. Questions were asked to assess the draft survey questions in terms of whether participants understood the question or had difficulty answering it, which aspects of the questions were unclear or confusing, if any, how certain or sure participants were of their response, so their sense of accuracy in answering the questions, how relevant the questions were to pregnant women and their partners, and the purpose of the questions. The two-hour cognitive interviews were in person and conducted individually with 18 parents or parents-to-be, including both men and women, who again were diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, age, SES, and parenting characteristics. Based on the participants' comments, we reduced the number of items in the empathy and masculinity scales, as well as revised some wording and revised the family leave questions. The pilot study allowed us to test the interview. The pilot study allowed us to test the interview instrument under actual survey conditions, providing a final check on the feasibility of the survey questions and response categories, as well as providing us an estimate of the respondent burden. We pre-tested the full set of scale items through an in-person interview with, again, diverse men and women who were parents or parents-to-be. In addition to answering the father resources questionnaire, participants provided feedback on the survey questions, such as the survey purpose and which questions were problematic. The interviewers also provided information on questions that participants did not understand or had difficulty answering. And based on the pilot test results, we revised the questionnaire by adding skips for certain characteristics, such as having no partner or no job, rewording some questions, dropping some of the problem questions, adding several family leave questions, and then, of course, revising interviewer instructions. So the final father resources instrument is a brief 29-item questionnaire that can be answered in approximately 9 minutes. It was developed for use with diverse mothers and fathers. And importantly, the questionnaire is multidimensional, capturing different types of psychological, social, and tangible resources that are relevant to pregnant women and their male partners, as well as to parenting. Finally, the survey questions included in the instrument are clear and easy for respondents to answer. So in conducting this research, our goal was to develop a father resources questionnaire that is relevant to maternal health and child well-being, that allows comparisons across groups, and which may be used in the National Children's Study. In the process of developing the questionnaire, our lessons learned included the importance of incorporating the multidimensional nature of father resources, the importance of using a well-defined logical measure development process, the importance of obtaining input from both mothers and fathers of diverse characteristics, and finally, the importance of recognizing time constraints for large survey efforts, such as the National Children's Study, by defining a limited, brief set of questionnaire items. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Lisa. So the next portion of our panel will be to shift to questions and answers and comments from you all with our esteemed colleagues here on the panel. So we heard a lot of great information today. I'd love to turn it over to you guys for questions. Please.
You're gathering a lot of data about maternal health, and I'm wondering if in the process of gathering this data, you consider looking at it in the other direction, how participation in fathers, how being encouraged and supported as a father will influence father's health. There's quite a bit of research that looks at that, the encouragement and support for kids back to quit smoking and live healthier lives and stuff like that. It seems like a pretty important consideration. I don't know if you thought about that since you got all the data.
So the question is whether there's a consideration on father support from other males
how do we encourage and support of the mother, in particular, but how overall participation and being an involved father, how that affects the father's health in particular?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. The NCS's focus, that slide I put up with that had the law, is focusing in on child health and development and as it relates maternal and child health. But I think that's an innovative way of viewing father health, that other direction. I don't know if you can tell much of that in the literature.
And actually, I should have mentioned, can you just mention your name and affiliation when you ask the question for our folks up here on the panel? Please.
Nancy Farron, Wallace, Portland State University at the Study Center. I have a question about the results of the literature review, specifically about fathers and, I have two questions, so which one should I answer first? The first one, okay, so I'll switch to the other one. Maybe the other one will come back to me. The other one was unfinished in the formative research group. That question is about, in clinics for medications and health communication. It sort of has to do with this other question. When it's a longitudinal observational study, there is a great risk of exposing people to health-promoting information and changing the results of the study. And I know since our contract was awarded in 2005, we've had to walk that fine line of not exposing people to health-promoting information and not keeping that as an incentive to change the study results. So that's something I think that the study center will have to weigh. Isn't that true?
You raised a very great point. These were just suggestions when that question was thrown out to the focus group. These were the types of suggestions that came back to the fathers.
It's on characteristics of the study collectors of the people who are communicating with the fathers. That came out in the focus group. Mm-hmm. People from my community, people who look like me. I didn't hear anything about gender, but does gender make a difference? In the studies that you reviewed, were characteristics of the people who were collecting data and whether or not they were community members, male, female, race, ethnicity, were they characterized?
They actually weren't. Neither in published literature nor in gray literature did anybody describe them in the conference. And that's very interesting. It probably means that they weren't really attending to that as a factor in their data collection, but I'm sure it would be an extremely important issue to look at were that information made available.
And this question was asked in the focus group. So when you talked about the trust of the trust focus group, they asked what type of that would you like to come to your home? They were very favorable of RN. It did not need to be, the gender did not matter, but they really looked at a professional type coming to their home. A little bit hesitant on just having a phlebotomist drawing blood from their child, so really favored that RN. But having the consistency in staff was a theme that we heard not only from our focus groups, but from the focus groups across the network. Good question.
Please.
Dr. Sundberg, Janet, from the Men's Health Caucus. Sort of a related question to this thing. I do wonder about whether the gender of the recruiter makes a difference from any of the others when we look at it. But also I'm interested in the rhetorical design of recruitment tools, and I think there was one presentation that suggested the rhetorical design is necessary. Is anyone aware of whether a rhetorical, gender-appropriate rhetorical design of a recruitment or screening tool is looked at and done? Are there scales that measure the gender appropriateness? If we have scales that measure health literacy appropriateness?
I know from the focus groups conducted by my colleague Suzanne in Delaware, in the area that she recruited, they actually had per diem staff who were members who lived within that community, and they were men, and they used them to go out and recruit
Yeah, and then
the rhetorical design of it, we're very interested in that, and one of the communication that can be appropriate to the target audience, but sometimes alternative when I do that information to men is sort of genericized and preliminary work that I'm doing now shows that much of it is geared to women, rhetorical preferences of women. And I think that's very interesting. I'm curious if you'd love to see it.
Okay. Yeah, over in the corner here.
Yeah, this issue has come up, you know, just internal to NIH and NICHD, you know, with what other studies are going on in relevant study segments, and you know, at least internally, we're trying to share information and to be well aware of what's going on in our particular protected study segments. But it's an ongoing challenge, you know, because there's so many. Formative research projects, sub-studies from other, you know, longitudinal studies that may have an influence on our work. But you know, this kind of siloed approach is a thing of the past. You know, so we're trying our best to communicate with one another, you know, agencies, institutes within NIH, and even communicating with local community. Community health organizations, community-based organizations, you know, it's really getting the word out there that we're in the segment and increasing the collaboration.
Up front here, sir? Yeah.
As a data collector for the Mount Sinai Queens County part of the National Children's Study, I was actually wondering in the data that you presented, Dr. Hill, about the fathers that actually did participate,
yeah.
Is there any way of actually looking at what is the gender of the actual interviewer? Because as I remember it, in the legacy, in page one, or page zero, whatever you want to call it. Yeah. So at that point, the mother basically granted permission to the
right.
for the father's participation. So I was wondering is there a correlation between the gender of the interviewer at that point, and then subsequent to that point, the gender of the person who actually came into the home?
No, I think that's a good question, and I think that data is available. I didn't use it here today, but I think that's something that we might be able to follow up on.
Because I'm wondering if that had any impact.
Absolutely.
Yes?
I looked at the original child study way back when you were looking at the possibilities of what you were going to send for, and they were just unbelievably expanded. And the final study that's going forward, are you collecting samples, like genetic samples on the mother and the father, and doing all those kind of careful link the dots, not only just for the piece of assessments that we saw today, but those actual factual pieces of information?
So we're being guided by, you know, these projects like these that are, you know, assessing feasibility, acceptability, and cost. So. That's to be determined based on several.
It's still open,
but we have several formative research projects that are looking at, environmental data collection, biospecimen. Several of our study centers are moving into an expanded data collection phase. So it depends on the success and those factors and how they will inform the main set. But yes, you know, everything's still on the table.
We'll go up in the front and then in the back.
Hi, my name is Caitlin Minder. I'm a enumerator for the St. Louis National Children's Study. Right now, we're largely ignoring fathers when we go door to door, but I was just wondering, we're about ready to start phase two. Would we be engaging fathers more then, or are we going to wait till the main study? I really have no idea.
Yeah. No, St. Louis is a part of my portfolio, and you all are moving forward to expand to phase two pretty soon, which will include the father interview. So More to come.
Yes, sir.
I'm an SDFIMS director of UMass College of Geography, also an investigator. And I just want to make a comment to your questions earlier, which I believe is very crucial. As part of the implementation of the SDS study itself, you know, there's a very extensive point-based process looking at the role of the study in the CA. So that by and large itself already established where the engagement can happen or not. The other thing, the other lessons I'd like to learn if we are facing currently is that by and large there's also a protective effect of the sites where the studies take place because a lot of them are already involved in academic research and therefore they are very protective about letting their participants or patients to be involved in the research. At the end of the day, I mean that the challenge that we will be facing, which is we've already experienced in Worcester, is retention. At the end of the day, you know, no matter how many that we manage to involve whole fathers, men, and families, in the long run, how many of them will be able to remain and keep engaged and to follow up? Our experience, for instance, for having implemented women health initiatives, we followed them over decades, and it was extensive community engagement and equipment and going into the home to keep 90% of our overall cohort from beginning to the end. At the end of the day, for the national student study, it feels like it's the same. Once you get these people, what you need to maintain their attention and to keep them there.
We need to tailor that for our participants. It's not one strategy that isn't going to work for one participant and can't be applied across all of this. So, you know, having been successful to the women's population at 97% success rate for 15 years, it was hard work, but it was dedication. Building that trust initially is the key component to having this longitudinal study work.
Question over here? Yeah.
Dr. Kelly Mejia with Einstein Healthcare Network in Philadelphia. I was just wondering if you guys would get any data on adolescent fathers, re-engagement into the family. And we know that father presence has a protective factor for sexual teenagers and adolescent females. What about the adolescent fathers who are usually disenfranchised and disengaged from the family on so many levels, not just the legal level, but the kids, it's their partner's level, it's their partner's parents' level, the grandparents, whoever the care systems are, the foster care systems, the juvenile detention center system, they have more layers than an adult male would have to disengage them from the family problem. Is there any thought of looking more at the adolescent father?
This formative research project, we did not look at teen fathers. The focus was on the teen mother, and we did some attempts to foster care on parents and those special groups. That is something that we can work with the quality of the different families to consider in the future.
Yep, right here.
I didn't introduce myself before. I'm Armin Broad. I'm an unaffiliated writer and researcher about fatherhood in California. The question that I had was, you were raising some very interesting points about going to the mother and having the mother be kind of the portal through which you're gathering the fathers. Have you considered, or this may be too late or something, but to gather information about fathers completely independently, names on birth certificates, men's groups, things like that, where you could start that way, and it would be a lot easier to track down the mother than it would be sometimes to track down the father, and you could match them up. It seems like there's an inherent barrier there, that there's sort of pre-selection by the women who are saying yes, and you mentioned that, but some are saying no, so you're getting almost a slightly skewed group.
Yeah, we spoke about this in our pre-meeting, you know, and, noted, agreed, and, under consideration, in terms of, the fragile families is the study that used this approach, and was that one of the studies that was at over 100% retention, or how did that?
Fragile families fared very well, given that what was a study that looked at biological mothers and fathers and their children. And they caught parents at the moment of birth of the child. They targeted primarily low-income families and families where the parents were not married. And they sought the fathers separately and followed them independently. So their target was a birth. at the hospital, but they caught those parents. And given that, he did remarkably well on retaining fathers. Most of them were lower income, non-residential, and yet adopted them. And it may be because they didn't go through mothers, except to say, hey, is the father here?
My name is Dorothy Brown, I'm a midwife, that's right, and when she was talking about fathers being, you know, you're talking, they're not visible, they're very visible at birth, that they may not always come to see me in fear or the formal ways that you guys are treating, but they are there for, I mean, really, I would say more than 7% of the time, so you're looking for it, that's really odd.
Wait a minute. Yep, please.
My name is Kelsey Kelly. I'm the University of Virginia National Public Health Student, and I want to know, from a history of talking about people all over across the nation, and about people, how are you going to start using social media to target education? Because I know she's adolescent, using, like, she talks about people 18 to 25, social media, which they use to talk about people 35, you know, they might not be people that are on Twitter, but they might be able to just Facebook. Like you said, Facebook is just amazing.
We are. You know, this is one of those interesting deals where, you know, as a federal employee, we don't have access to Twitter or Facebook, but our contractors do, you know, and they all, you know, were tasked with developing a social media plan that accounted for, you know, kind of local relevant details of demographic information and how, you know, various social media options might be affected. So, you know, in short, yes, we're doing that, and we hope, we would like to hope that it's being tailored to the population of interest for the study center. Yeah. But we can't monitor it, you know, because it's so interesting. We can't access it.
As you all are formulating additional questions, is there any other thoughts that you guys want to throw back out from maybe any of the questions that have been asked so far that you didn't have a chance to respond to? Okay. Just wanted to make sure you had a chance to say your piece.
Yeah. I did have one, you know, with the providing health promotional material, you know, as a potential confounding influence. We brought this up to our executive steering committee for the National Children's Center. Because we've been discussing this for some time, you know, it's almost like there's an oath you take as a public health practitioner that, you know, there's an opportunity to provide information that you'll do that. But then you're talking about a study and consistency. So they actually endorsed this idea. So there's the IRB issue around, you know, this local IRBs and the federal IRB, but in terms of, you know, the committee that kind of governs our forward movement, they thought that providing health promotion material during study visits was permissible. So, still in play, but an interesting question.
Yes, sir.
Yes, so Lawrence Brown, I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Morgan State University. To that point, Dr. Hill raised, can you elaborate more about what Min said about information they wanted to receive in the study that you mentioned?
I remember the one focus group quite vividly, and it was probably the most engaging of the focus groups, but it was about the support systems, and they were very open, there was one in particular who had gone through a very difficult birth, and his wife was in ICU, you know, he was going back and forth between floors trying to manage the child and manage his wife, but then manage his own emotions going through this process. So he said, you know, the nurses were there, but they're so busy, you know, but they were there for me. But if I had a support system at that time, that would be useful. So the other said, you know, is there a phone number that I can call and just talk about what I'm going through? There's a lot of support systems in classes for the mothers, but it's like the fathers are left out. So they really thought that, you know, if there's something we could give out at the study center, having these support systems or having these groups here, fathers who are in the study, they have similar age children, they can just go and talk, they can vent, they can, you know, share stories, lessons learned. So that's what they really wanted to get back, or requested, or the discussion forum.
Right, so along those lines, like fathers you think they would respond?
You raise a good point about how we manage this on a study level and how do we give that to the fathers. But maybe tailoring the support groups so it's in line of what the study is trying to promote without crossing that line as far as diagnosis or treatment.
Please.
So in the beginning, you know, so we haven't started the main study yet, right? And we're in this vanguard, you know, kind of pilot phase, you know. Changing the focus, you know, our purpose is stated, and you know, we're interested in monitoring and improving child health and development at the broad level. But this is why we implement these projects, so that we can find out more about engaging fathers and what they might want to receive in the face of some of the challenges we have with providing information, you know. So essentially, you know, this is why, you know, we're doing what we're doing now, is to fine tune, you know, our details so that we could be as successful as possible. So change is imminent. I mean, and it will happen based on what we learned from our work.
Did you have another comment, sir?
I was going to physically add to what Dr. Bill said. I think our experience by and large is that the fathers, they are accepting of the fact that these just about children and they divide them into what they want. They're concerned by, however, what is it that do they get back from it. And sometimes it's not what they get back themselves as men or as fathers. Most of them they're saying, I would want someone to, for instance, that my child
Please, yeah, go ahead.
Going to your comment about support, desire, that's another aspect of father resources as well. So in terms of the data collection of the information on fathers, that would be something to do in the future as well. It actually was among our list of 30 items out there to take a look at. So not only a support group, but also their friends, who are their friends, what are they doing, are they in the medical field, are they also fathers, those sorts of, that kind of information would be helpful to know about the people who are in the study, separate from any kind of support for retention.
And I can speak to those fathers when asked about their support system. Their brothers and sisters-in-law have had children, they already went through that experience, or their friends or neighbors had children.
As we look to conclude, are there any final thoughts from you all as a panel for our audience today? Great. Well, please join me in thanking our panel for a great conversation.